Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. The National Weather Service is predicting some severe winter weather coming up, and we'll have details on how you can prevent flooding and get some sandbags. Then we'll take you to a rally of Iraqi Chaldeans in El Cajon, where religious and political leaders are urging the county's redistricting commission not to separate their community that's 50,000 strong. From California News Service, hear about concerns voiced by civil rights leaders seeking to protect racial equity in the state's redistricting process. Here in San Diego, supervisors heard from public health officials this week on the alarming rise in drug overdose deaths, particularly fentanyl. Hear what the county is doing to try and reduce that tragic toll on today's show. On Green Scene, we'll have a special report on the troubled Ocotillo Wind Energy Facility, which has been offline for over 3 months since a multi-ton turbine collapsed, and it's far from the first serious threat to public safety at the facility, as we'll report today. From California News Service, we'll also have news on blue carbon ecosystems, including wetlands protections in San Diego, as well as a report on what cities around the world can do to help address climate change. We'll also tell you about the birth of a very special baby one long ago Christmas Eve. No, not the one in Bethlehem. This is a child born in the De Anza Expedition's encampment in East County several centuries ago. From Public News Service, we'll have some national news stories, including calls to limit executive privilege and the death of former senator and presidential candidate Bob Dole. December 7th marked the 80th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack that drew the U.S. into World War II. So today, we'll be re-airing our interview with the late Dr. Ken Hansen, recalling the Pearl Harbor attack when he was a young boy living in Hawaii, and how the historic event impacted his family, the community, and the holiday season. Then we'll have some tips to keep your pets safe this holiday season, followed by reporter Nadine Abbott sharing her childhood holiday memories in Acapulco. We'll end our show with some holiday music, including country Christmas sounds from the U.S. Army Band and the Children's Choir's rendition of We Wish You a Merry Christmas. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Show, where East County matters. Potentially heavy rains are expected around the county starting Monday night through Tuesday. Rain can cause flooding and erosion, especially in areas that have burned, such as in the December 2020 Valley Fire near Alpine. Rain runoff can sweep topsoil and debris downstream, where it can damage homes, clog culverts, and storm drains, or flood roadways. The County of San Diego and CAL FIRE are offering free sandbags to residents who live in the unincorporated areas. The sandbags, or in some cases, bags alone, are available at most rural fire stations. Be sure to bring a shovel to fill the bags, and if possible, call ahead since some stations have limited supplies. You can find a complete list of fire stations offering sand and bags at countynewscenter.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. Coming up next, the Chaldean Corner on East County Magazine's radio show, bringing you news for and about our region's Iraqi Chaldean community.
The Chaldean community of El Cajon spoke out on Tuesday against recent county redistricting proposals.
Ladies and gentlemen, our community is under threat again. This time, it's right here in the United States.
That's the voice of Vince Catula, a Chaldean activist, at the Keep East County United rally and press conference. He continued.
The County of San Diego Independent Redistricting Commission, also known as the IRC, is seeking to divide a strong and unified Chaldean community by separating El Cajon from Rancho San Diego and the remainder of East County. We have thousands of residents, hundreds of businesses, and multiple churches within El Cajon and Rancho San Diego, and we call upon the IRC to not break up a 50-year community of interest and save the community in which we live, work, and pray.
Chaldean Americans have found a home in and around El Cajon for over 50 years. But what has been built over this half century by generations of people is now on the line, as county redistricting is putting their unified voice at risk of being fractured. The event, held at El Cajon's Centennial Plaza, was a rapid response to the Independent Redistricting Committee releasing their proposed maps for supervisorial districts, which are scheduled to be finalized on December 14th. Groups of people like Chaldeans are supposed to be kept together in county districts, designated as communities of interest, since they are not formally counted by the Census Bureau. Yet the newly proposed maps currently split large chunks of this community away from each other. El Cajon will be lumped in with Hillcrest, Claremont Mesa, and North Park neighborhoods of District 4. Meanwhile, Rancho San Diego, which is in the unincorporated part of El Cajon, would get separated into District 2 along with Lakeside, Santee, and Alpine. Many local leaders and community members turned out to voice their concern with the changes, surrounding the podium with banners and signs. Dr. Nuri Barca, president of the Chaldean Community Council, addressed the crowd.
We believe this is a politically motivated map to diminish our voice as an ethnic minority, undermining our community's ability to choose our representative is a threat to our civil liberties, and we are not going to accept it. We ask for a fair map to protect our right to a fair representation in our government. We are a community of interest, and El Cajon is our heart, and we cannot live without it. Thank you so much.
Barca also reminded the crowd that this area is now home to the largest number of Chaldean Christians in the world at over 50,000 people. Coming to the United States from their Iraq homeland due to religious persecution and economic hardship, they maintain a tightly knit community across families, schools, and local governments in East County. Afaf Konja, the spokesperson for the rally, noted how El Cajon would potentially share a district with neighborhoods who do not necessarily share their values or lifestyle.
The redistricting maps in previous decades kind of made sense, and it kept El Cajon, you know, here. This year, it's quite a shift in the structure of its mapping, and it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense culturally, it doesn't make any sense business-wise, it doesn't make any sense politically, other than to dilute a vote and to silence a people.
Those who spoke also included the Cajon Valley School Board president, a Chaldean bishop, El Cajon community activists, and Bill Wells, the mayor of El Cajon. During the rally, Wells said,
I'm here to tell you something, and the Independent Redistricting Commission should know this. It is against the law to make decisions on redistricting based upon political will, political ideology.
Indeed, both Catula and Konja made clear that Keep East County United has retained legal counsel, and that while they hope it is not necessary, further steps toward litigation will be taken in the event that the current maps stand. The committee's decisions are pivotal for the Chaldean community, but as several speakers acknowledge, they also matter for all of East County if the area wants to remain a cohesive region. Rick Wilson, president and CEO of the East County Chamber of Commerce, spoke on this.
We feel this is incredibly important to have a day like this to make sure that the entire San Diego community knows that East County is important. The synergies that have been created over years with the surrounding cities and unincorporated areas has been immense, and we don't want to lose that. East County is incredible, and by doing what they're looking to do in the redistricting, it's not only going to hurt the entire of East County, but the business community that we have developed for so long out here.
As the rally came to a close, a chant grew and grew until the entire crowd was heard echoing around the plaza.
Save El Cajon!
Save El Cajon!
Don't divide El Cajon!
Don't divide El Cajon!
Hear our voice!
Don't silence us!
Keep Chaldeans in East County!
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 Save the Chaldean community!
Save the Chaldean community!
Hear our voice!
Hear our voice!
Hear our voice!
Hear our voice!
The redistricting committee met last night at 5:30 p.m. in the County Administration Center in downtown San Diego to further consider the draft maps. And Keep East County United helped transport Chaldeans to the scene to make their voice heard. The meeting went long into the night, and while possible changes were discussed, no final decisions were reached. The redistricting committee is scheduled to meet for a final time to approve the maps this coming Tuesday at 2 p.m. To submit a request to speak at the meeting, submit a virtual comment, or for more information on redistricting in San Diego County, visit www.sandiegocounty.gov/redistricting. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Elijah McKee.
As California enters the final stretch in the redistricting process, civil rights groups are pressing the state's redistricting commission to prioritize racial equity so historically underrepresented groups have a better shot at electing leaders of their choice. The California Redistricting Commission is holding public meetings on the draft legislative maps almost every day. The maps are expected to be approved on December 24th. Kathy Fang with California Common Cause says communities of interest need to examine the proposed maps closely.
We should be looking really hard about whether the proposed lines are drawn in a way that maybe they inadvertently or intentionally hurt a community, but they're drawn that way in order to help an incumbent.
Advocates want voting districts that avoid pitting minority groups against each other and that keep communities of interest together. The California Redistricting Commission is now taking public comment on the draft maps at its meetings and on its website. Brendan Jessup with the nonprofit State Voices says advocates need to delve deep into the census data and press the state commission to consider where communities of color are likely to grow.
We need to also say that in the next 5 years, this community will now be a minority-majority community, and then therefore, we have to give them the agency to elect folks that look like them that reflect their interests.
Groups are also preparing to sue under the Voting Rights Act if they deem the final maps unfair. To bring such a case, attorneys look for places where a minority group is large enough to comprise a majority, where there's a history of racially polarized voting or racial discrimination, and where the minority group is being outvoted. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
County supervisors recently heard an update on efforts to combat the fentanyl crisis through a countywide substance abuse harm reduction strategy. Dr. Wilma Wooten, County Public Health Officer, said there has been a stark increase in accidental overdose deaths from 2019 through October 2021, and most of those were due to fentanyl. She told supervisors, "While we have evaluated the COVID-19 crisis, our region faces another public health crisis. So far this year, over 1,000 people have died of overdoses, including more than 600 from fentanyl. That's a 200% increase over last year. The impact is most significant in small communities. For example, Dr. Wooten said Native Americans represent a small percentage of the county's population, and yet Native Americans have the highest overdose death rate of any ethnic or racial group locally." Dr. Nicole Esposito, Assistant Director of Behavioral Health Services, presented some shocking numbers.
As Dr. Wooten makes clear, our region is facing a massive public health crisis related to harms from substance misuse, and it is disproportionately impacting communities of color. The numbers are dramatic. From 2016 to 2020, the rate of death due to fentanyl-related overdoses among San Diego County residents increased by 990%. But part of what we want to emphasize is not only the gravity of these especially tragic consequences, which often hit families like bolts of lightning, but also the less visible but still devastating harms that come from chronic substance use. For example, 2020 marked the largest increase in the number of alcohol-related deaths in San Diego County over the last 5 years, with 302 deaths, a 65% increase from 2016 and 38% increase from 2019. And we estimate that 1 in 13 San Diegans, or about 8% of our population, have a substance use disorder. This follows similar national estimates.
The county's strategy is focusing on harm reduction, with a priority to keep people alive. Dr. Wooten said distribution of naloxone, a nasal spray to counter overdoses, to first responders has been very impactful. Naloxone is available to the public at public health centers, and it's been distributed at other locations, but wider dispersal is needed. The goal is to distribute 33,000 naloxone kits annually. A new screening program for addiction is being implemented through a pilot program in detention centers, starting with pregnant women at Las Colinas who are receiving medication for addiction. In addition, American Rescue Act funds are being utilized to help connect homeless individuals who have substance abuse disorders to treatment in San Diego. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Marie Johnson with the Green Scene Report. All turbines at the Ocotillo Wind Energy Facility have been offline since September 20, when a massive wind turbine collapsed. According to a report published by the California ISO on December 8, the shutdown of more than 3 months is listed as forced. Neither Pattern Energy, operator of the wind facility, nor the U.S. Bureau of Land Management, which owns the land where the facility is located, responded to our emails asking when the turbines might be operational again and what steps are planned or perhaps mandated to protect public safety in the future. This is the latest in a series of serious safety incidents and shutdowns at the Ocotillo Wind Facility. Another turbine collapsed in 2016 at the project, as we reported at East County Magazine. That collapse prompted an inquiry by State Senator Ben Hoiso. The manufacturer, Siemens, blamed that failure on a malfunction that resulted in a blade striking the tower, but Siemens has a long history of turbine failures. Ocotillo Wind, built by Pattern Energy, also had a wind turbine fire in January 2015 when a turbine burst into flames. An 11-ton blade hurled off onto a public trail in May 2013, among other mechanical failures. The project has around 112 turbines in total. An ECM investigation after the blade fell off prompted a worldwide curtailment and found the company's history riddled with allegations that also included bribery, corruption, and other scandals. In 2014, ECM revealed that an international wind expert concluded that the project's developers had defrauded the federal government to pocket subsidies, falsifying data to imply the site had higher wind speeds than exist in Ocotillo. Then Congressman Bob Filner warned the Treasury Department about the fraud allegations and suggested the project should be halted. The California Native American Heritage Commission also found the project was on sacred sites and urged then State Attorney General Kamala Harris to sue the federal government to halt the project, but she cited a conflict of interest and no filing was done. Native American tribal leaders implored then-President Obama to stop the project, but it proceeded. In records pulled by East County Magazine, for the first 3 years after the project was built, it had failed to produce the amount of promised power each year.
Residents of Ocotillo have been subjected to perils resulting from the wind project beyond blades hurling off and turbines collapsing.
Stripping off topsoil has led to massive dust storms, and chemicals used to control dust resulted in potentially toxic white sludge flowing through the streets during storms, a substance that becomes flammable once it dries out, as ECM reported. The project stands, silently for now, as the epitome of green energy gone wrong, built in an area without adequate winds, with a history of serious mechanical failures, including turbine collapses, a blade whirling off, and a fire, all without producing the power that it promised.
Coastal protection groups are pressing California to prioritize so-called blue carbon ecosystems in the fight against climate change. Dozens of groups have sent a letter to the head of the California Natural Resources Agency asking for action to protect existing wetlands and near-shore areas and restore those that have been degraded. Gilly Lyons with the Pew Charitable Trusts is among those who signed the letter.
The request from the signers is to protect biodiversity, to store and sequester carbon, and to mitigate the effects of climate change that we're already living with, things like ocean acidification, storm surges, coastal flooding, etc.
The letter comes during the public comment period for a draft of the CNRA's new Natural and Working Lands Climate Smart Strategy to be finalized early next year. Last year, Governor Gavin Newsom issued an executive order requiring state agencies to act to accelerate the natural removal of carbon and build climate resilience, especially in lower-income communities. Angela Kemsley is with the group Wild Coast, which is currently restoring two lagoons in San Diego County. She says natural features like eelgrass beds are important tools in climate mitigation.
They're actually much more efficient at storing this carbon than land-based plants. And so they're able to take a bunch of carbon out of the atmosphere, store it in the soil, and that helps to fight climate change.
According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, 90% of California's historic wetlands have been drained for agriculture and development over the past century. Support for this reporting was provided by the Pew Charitable Trusts. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org. A new report finds that American cities and counties should make it their goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 63% by 2030 in order to live up to the Paris Agreement and keep global warming in check. In April, President Joe Biden pledged to reduce greenhouse gas emissions 50% by 2030. Angie Fife is with ICLEI USA Local Governments for Sustainability, which produced the report. She says cities ought to set their sights even higher.
Because we are a more developed and wealthier nation, in order to achieve our fair share of emissions reductions, we have set targets for cities at 63% reduction by 2030.
ICLEI USA helps local governments create an inventory of their greenhouse gas emissions, set science-based targets, and develop a plan to reduce them. Many cities are replacing their fleets of cars and buses with electric vehicles, making their towns more pedestrian and cyclist-friendly, and helping families insulate their homes and buy electric appliances to improve energy efficiency. Mayor Sam Liccardo says the city of San Jose formed a community choice energy program that allows customers to buy power derived from renewable sources in an effort to help green the grid.
And since that time, we've seen just a dramatic improvement in our portfolio. We're now 90% GHG free, and our goal, of course, is to get to 100.
San Jose also has moved to prevent urban sprawl by setting aside land for open space and is building out a network of electric vehicle charging stations. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The first case of the newly identified Omicron COVID-19 variant has been found in San Diego. The patient is a local resident who recently traveled abroad. The patient has not been hospitalized, but is under isolation. The county is investigating to identify anybody else who may have had close contact with the patient. Omicron, first identified in November in South Africa, appears to spread more easily than previous versions of COVID, though early data suggests it may tend to cause fewer severe outcomes. Though the Omicron variant has been found in 28 U.S. states so far, the Delta variant remains the greatest concern, accounting for the vast majority of serious illnesses, hospitalizations, and deaths from COVID in the U.S., according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control. The local patient had a breakthrough case. The patient had been vaccinated and had a booster shot, which likely protected that patient from a severe case. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, says, "We expected that the Omicron variant would make its way to San Diego, and it has. We are continuing to monitor for the Omicron variant and will report any other cases to the public when they are identified." Dr. Wooten recommends the following measures to protect against all varieties of COVID-19. Get vaccinated and get a booster if you qualify. And now, boosters are available and recommended for everyone age 16 and up, where it's been more than 6 months from your last Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, or for adults if it's been more than 2 months from your Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Vaccines are available free at healthcare providers, pharmacies, and community clinics. You can make an appointment or find a site near you by calling 833-422-4255 or visiting the MyTurn website that the state runs. Wear a mask, especially in public indoors, regardless of vaccination status. Get tested if you have any symptoms, whether you've been vaccinated or not. You can get a free test appointment or find a walk-in test clinic at coronavirus-sd.com. Wash your hands frequently, stay home if you're sick, and practice social distancing. You can find more information about COVID-19, testing, and vaccinations at coronavirus-sd.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
On December 24th, back in 1775, Juan Bautista de Anza's colonizing expedition from Spain spent the night in Coyote Canyon, an area that's now part of the Anza-Borrego Desert in Borrego Springs. Writer Dick Overturf penned these words about that ordeal. It was Noche Buena, Christmas Eve, in Anza's camp. It was cold, foggy, and rainy. Earlier, it had been snowing. Everyone and everything was wet. Babies were crying. Women were weeping. Dead cattle lay on the ground. Hundreds of horses, mules, burros, and cattle were milling around Maria Gertrudis Rivas, who was in labor. Few could sleep, and the mountain Cahuilla Indians were watching. Who were these intruders? The soldiers and settlers in De Anza's expedition had been on the march north from Mexico for 87 days when they reached Coyote Canyon, seeking the promised land at Mission San Gabriel. An earthquake struck that night also, rattling the group's composure amid the bitter cold. After Friar Pedro Font recited evening prayers or vespers, Colonel Anza distributed a potent brandy drink, aguardiente, to raise his soldiers' morale. Friar Font took offense, declaring that it is not right to celebrate the birth of the infant Jesus with drunkenness, to which De Anza replied, "I do not give it to them to get drunk." He insisted that the king had ordered the brandy for the soldiers, but warned that if any soldier was found drunk outside his tent, he would be punished. Friar Font later reported that the people that night were so noisy, singing and dancing from the effects of the liquor, not caring that we were in so bad a mountain in the rain, and so delayed with the saddle animals and tired cattle, but such is the rule of those absolute lords. This was not the first time Friar Font had scolded the expedition's commander. Just 1 week earlier, a fandango, or jubilant dance and feast, was held. The fandango at San Felipe, said Font, was somewhat discordant, and a very bold widow who came with the expedition sang some verses which were not at all nice, applauded and cheered by all the crowd. Now, at the Christmas Eve encampment in Coyote Canyon, after the celebration died down, the friar comforted a soldier's wife who had been in labor since the day before. "She was fearful of dying, and I consoled her as best I could," he wrote. Shortly before midnight on Christmas Eve, the soldier's wife gave birth to a baby boy who was christened Salvador Ignacio Linares. He was the third child born on the expedition and the first white child born in California. A monument honoring the baby's birth on the eve of the Nativity still stands today, about 2.25 miles from Anza Ridge, near the San Diego County line. The day after the child's birth, the weary band of travelers rested before continuing on their way. Father Font delivered a sermon and then wished them all Feliz Navidad or Merry Christmas. The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
As President Biden recognized, these are key documents that the Congress should have, and they should have them right now.
Douglas Letter, general counsel for the U.S. House, argued when it comes to claims of executive privilege, the judgment of the current president should outweigh any predecessors. A federal appeals court agreed, saying there is a unique legislative need for the January 6th committee to see former President Donald Trump's notes, diaries, and other documents, and ruled against Trump's motion to suppress them. Meanwhile, the House approved a bill to establish new limits on executive branch power. Tennessee Democrat Stephen Cohen said the Protecting Our Democracy Act would curb abuses of power tested by Trump.
The president tried to use the pardon power to take care of people who took care of him to shut them up so they wouldn't testify against him. Roger Stone, Mike Flynn, you name it.
Florida Republican Byron Donalds accused Democrats of obsessing over Trump.
It is without question what a successful administration looks like, one that actually always followed the law, was in constant standing with the law, as opposed to an administration who issues mandates that are unconstitutional, that the federal courts, as we speak, are undermining every single day.
The bill would limit pardons, require presidential candidates to submit personal tax returns, and ban foreign contributions to ballot measures. A federal judge decided not to block a lawsuit challenging parts of Georgia's new election law, including limits on the use of ballot drop boxes and photo ID requirements for absentee voting, which opponents argue are discriminatory. Republicans contend the measures are needed to increase election security. The Senate passed a bill empowering Democrats to raise the debt limit on their own. Once signed into law, the measure would allow the borrowing limit to be raised with a simple majority vote instead of facing the usual 60-vote hurdle to move legislation forward. Former Senator Bob Dole lies in state at the U.S. Capitol after passing away Sunday at the age of 98. During a short ceremony, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer paid tribute to his former colleague, who was struck by enemy fire during World War II.
By 21, Bob had given more of himself than most of us give in a lifetime. And then he kept going for 77 years after that. And my God, it was 77 years well spent.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell commended Dole's advocacy for people with disabilities and noted his White House aspirations.
Bob was the last of the greatest generation to run for president. But he was never stuck in the past. His roots ran deep. But he was always looking to new horizons.
President Joe Biden will deliver a eulogy at Dole's memorial service today at Washington National Cathedral. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy online at publicnewsservice.org.
December 7th marked the 80th anniversary of the Pearl Harbor attack that launched the U.S. into World War II. So today we're going to replay our interview with Dr. Ken Hansen, who recently passed away, unfortunately, but his words live on, recalling his childhood in Pearl Harbor on the day of that infamous attack and the holiday season that followed. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine and KNSJ. Today, I'm very honored to have as my guest Ken Hansen, my next-door neighbor. All week, we've been talking with staff and friends and people across East County about their most interesting holiday recollections, and so today, Ken is going to share one of his. But first, a little bit of background. Ken, you were just a young man when your family moved to Hawaii in 1937. I understand that was a very auspicious day.
That is correct. We sailed on the old Malolo from Los Angeles to San Francisco and then to Hawaii. And the day that we sailed from San Francisco was the day that Amelia Earhart went down.
My goodness.
And which became the headline news for days and weeks.
Around the world.
So that was, in a sense, made that day very special that I remember sailing for Hawaii to live. And I was very excited about the whole thing. Also, we sailed under the Golden Gate Bridge, which just yep. weeks after it had opened.
Ah, San
so
Francisco.
That, too, was very exciting as I think back.
Now, fast forward a couple of years to December 7th, 1941. You were living in Honolulu that holiday season, or just before the Christmas season, when Pearl Harbor was bombed. What was the first inkling you had that something was very wrong?
I lived in Honolulu at the time. I was home with my father and a university student who lived with us.
And you were how old?
I was 13 in eighth grade, and we could hear noises off in the distance, rumblings. But there had been a lot of preliminary building up of defense-type noises prior to this day as the possibility of war had escalated. So nothing much was made of these sounds except that one of us said, that must be Punch Bowl erupting.
The volcano.
Punch Bowl is an extinct volcano in Honolulu, which is now a national cemetery of renown.
But at that time,
it was a place where we went for picnics. Well, obviously, Punch Bowl wasn't erupting, and we had a frantic telephone call from my aunt, mm-hmm. who lived in a home on the beach beside Diamond Head, and she had seen with her own eyes a Japanese plane go by very low, so that she actually had eye contact, she thought, with the pilot.
Wow.
And she frantically called us and said that we are being attacked and don't move, like everybody else was saying.
Now, you were taking a typing class in school at the time, and I understand that very night you sat down at home with your typewriter and you typed up a memoir. I can't
believe that I did it, but yes, I was taking typing. And, of course, had just been to class, the last class on Friday.
Would you be willing to read it to us?
Sure. I'll read part of it, and we can talk about part of it, too.
And you've told me this was one of the most memorable days in your life?
This was indeed a memorable day in that things stand out so clearly even now, just as the other day in my life, my wedding day, stands out with great detail. I called this Memoirs of a Bombay Day. That was my 13-year-old sense of humor. We were having breakfast, as usual, on Sunday morning, Nabucco, the university student at our house, and I, when we heard a faint rumbling in the distance. Nabucco went to the door and said to me, "Punch bowl must be erupting." Well, we just laughed and forgot about that. And that was around 7:45 or 8 o'clock. And about a quarter to nine, I was getting ready to go to Sunday school, which I was supposed to do, when my aunt called frantically from where she lived off of Diamond Head on the beach and said, "Turn the radio on quickly," that Waianae was under fire. Waianae was one of the areas that was hit, but only one of many. We turned it on right away and were just in time to hear that Oahu was under attack, that we should stay calm, go at once to our houses, stay put, and keep the radio on all time. My father heard this, I'm ad-libbing now, and he found this very hard to believe, as did many people in the islands, that something actually bad was happening. They wanted to assume that this was practice.
Sure.
And it wasn't real. But wow. It was real.
It had to be terrifying for you.
I wasn't terrified. This was a sense of thrill and excitement and fear all mixed up in a 13-year-old's mind. My mother was away at the time that this was happening.
Back to the memoir now.
Yes. When my daddy just laughed and said it was all practice or something like that, not to worry about it, she called, again frantically like my aunt, and said what she was seeing. She happened to be working with a group of university students at an area called Aiea Heights, which overlooks Pearl Harbor. So she sat there and was seeing what was happening. And she, too, said, "Don't move, I'll get home with the car as soon as I can." She had three students that she had to take home first. Announcements kept coming over the wire saying for no one to go out on the streets and for everyone to get off and stay off them. Daddy still laughed and said that since Sunday school was not very far away, that I might as well go. I refused. Meanwhile, we could see puffs of smoke coming up over the hills and hear what sounded like shooting and so forth. I begged to stay home. Then Mother got home, and she was able to describe precisely what she had been seeing. But I must say that even then, my father had trouble believing it. When he saw it in print, the first newspapers came out a little later in the morning through the neighborhoods, extra, extra, and he could see it. He gave in.
Your parents were very involved in this whole thing. Your mother, I understand, had a very close call herself.
She had to drive home, and there were several areas where anti-aircraft fire had come from Pearl Harbor into Honolulu. There was no actual bombing of Honolulu, but there were places where fires were started, and she could have been hit by an anti-aircraft.
It was shrapnel.
Shrapnel, yeah, whatever. Anyway, she got home safely, delivered to her students, and all was well.
Your father worked at the university.
Yes. My dad worked for the Agricultural Extension Service at the University of Hawaii. And with his expertise, he and others in his office were immediately taken by the government. First of all, military rule took over immediately that day. Military rule was called. And he and others were called to the Capitol downtown. They cleared the throne room of the thrones and put in desks immediately. So the very next day, Monday, he was at a desk down there helping to assess the food situation for Oahu and the other islands, finding out how much was available and where it was available and how it was going to be distributed.
I understand that your father also wrote a memoir, Ken, of that time. Could you read a little bit of what he wrote?
He did, with considerable detail, and we are certainly grateful to him for having sat down and done that in the midst of a terribly busy time. He was working at the Extension Service in food distribution and production, and the director already had a job on the Territorial Food Committee, and they went to work even Sunday morning, and by Monday my father was in his office at the Capitol. Inventories of food and feed were made instantly. I'm reading from his own writing. The grocery stores were crowded and then ordered closed Tuesday for inventory. Note that the situation is different here than on the mainland. 65% of our food, and again I'm quoting, is imported. And if no ships come in, we eat sparingly. Wednesday, when the stores were opened and normal requirements were sold, but the shelves were low. The big wholesalers hold the keys, which appear to be good. There are relatively few wholesalers in town. and inventories were easily made. One small job I had to do was get information from 15 dealers of food by Monday morning between 11 and 11:45. The Central Committee met at Iolani Palace by noon. We are now standing by for more. This was written the day after.
Yeah, and your father's name was?
Kenneth Hansen.
Just like yours, so Kenneth Hansen.
Yep.
The second. Very good. Thank you for sharing that. So what was that first night like? Here you're at home, the island's just been bombed.
The first night was certainly memorable for an excitable 13-year-old.
You've written about it, I see.
Our house was situated on a hill, and we normally had a nice view with many lights to be seen. Of course, this was total blackout then, and we sat and peered out the windows at total blackness. And the big thing was not knowing, were they coming back? Were they coming back that night? Were they going to land the next day on the beaches? Were they coming to get us? What was going to happen?
We
did not know. Manoa Valley, where I lived, was usually bright with lights, and it was gray as the mountains behind it. Every so often we could see a blue light from a car, but they did not last long. About 8:15 we managed to find our beds and pile in them. I think all of us were glad to do so.
Now, you were active in the Boy Scouts at the time, and I understand that they helped with some of the things that needed to be done.
Yeah, at the time I was in Troop 1 of Honolulu, and the very next day, by afternoon, they had gotten hold of us and corralled us, and we met at a school, and we were trucked downtown Honolulu, where we were assigned to the city hall, well, other places too, but I was at the city hall. We helped with sandbagging.
Sandbagging to protect against shrapnel.
Building up against the buildings, yes. We were supposed to be messengers and take messages from one downtown building to another, which didn't particularly happen. But again, looking up to the sky and hearing or seeing a plane made us wonder if they were coming back. Nobody knew who was coming or when. So that was part of the excitement and fear of the day. It was a mixture of excitement and fear.
Now, you also volunteered at a hospital with the Scouts.
Well, with the Scouts, we were out of school for 2 months or more.
No school for 2 months.
And most of the time we were busy, thanks to the Scouts, because we were assigned to such jobs as handing out gas masks at schools, helping with draft physicals because there was major drafting going on at the time, and working at a hospital, carrying boxes and doing whatever needed doing. Every place was a beehive of activity, and it was good. It kept us off the streets and doing something that was
trouble.
That was helpful.
There you go.
Yes, indeed.
Now, when Christmas came along, it was very different that year. Obviously, no holiday lights. The blackout was still
effect. Total blackout. Christmas came along 2.5 weeks later.
Did you have a Christmas tree?
And no Christmas trees. A freighter carrying evergreens from the state of Washington was torpedoed somewhere between Washington and Honolulu, and that would have been most of the trees that people would have bought.
Mm-hmm.
So
what
down,
did you do?
Down they went. So we had to make do. We pulled up banana leaves and other things from the yard or the yard next door, and we got out the ribbons and the ornaments and put them on. Of course, no lights, because at that time we at night had only a storeroom with no windows to sit in if we wanted to be up and at 'em.
Wow.
Eventually the kitchen was blacked off with denim and tape and stuff so we could sit in the kitchen. But it's pretty hot and humid in Hawaii, and it wasn't...
Yes, it is.
It wasn't pleasant sitting in a room all evening. So.
No, you're used to opening the windows and enjoying those ocean breezes.
Yeah, so then it had to be dark.
Now, for holiday dinner, was that affected?
I can't remember our holiday dinner. We were with my uncle and aunt and family, and...
You've told me that traditionally in your family, your grandfather owned a turkey ranch someplace.
Yeah, we expected a turkey from California, since my grandfather owned a turkey ranch and usually had a turkey or two fattened up, especially for us, for the holidays.
But not that year?
No, it may have been that year we had it for Thanksgiving. I just don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise, it probably went down on another ship.
Oh, my goodness. So this went on for 4 years. You stayed in the islands throughout the war, I understand.
Yes, yes. We stayed until it was time for me to go away to college. An amazing time to have lived there. In many ways, we were probably like normal teenagers, but our schooling was disrupted because the armed forces took over many of the schools. My particular school, called an intermediate school, was divided in three parts, and we were left with the Quonset hut-type part of the school, and the main part was taken over by the Army. And we had classes only half a day, and other parts of our school had to go to elementary schools that were available for other half days. So we were divided up into actually three parts and scattered around the city. And then when it came time for high school, 10th grade, and I was transferred to Punahou School, the Army had the school, and we were given and using a building at the University of Hawaii. The School of Education was our school until August of 1945, and the war was over, and the Army immediately gave the school back, and there was a frantic rush to put it back in order.
Now, you went on later in life to become a very successful doctor. Did those early days working in that hospital and seeing all the injuries and the suffering that you must have seen as a young man, did that influence your decision to want to help people by becoming a physician?
I'm pretty sure it did. I think really of those first days of the war when I got to be in the hospital and going all over and carrying things and having a feel for it. And then 2 years later, along around 10th grade, I had a summer job at the hospital where I really saw things going on and had a good feel for it and felt like I liked it. I didn't mind the sights and so forth and so on, working with patients, carrying dishes, and so forth.
Well, there you go.
So that must have been an influence as I look back, yes.
So often this time of year we hear the term peace on earth, and I think a lot of us probably don't stop to reflect on how much we take that for granted until you've been through something like the bombing of Pearl Harbor and have gone on to tell about that.
Yes, peace on earth escaped us that year, 1941, and through the awful years of the Second World War. And during this time, I, of course, along with my schoolmates, matured and learned something about the world. And by the time the war was over, we knew an awful lot more than we did as eighth graders when it all started.
I could imagine. Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine show here on KNSJ.
It is a pleasure to be here and think about it and talk about it.
It's time to deck the halls for the holiday season, but some holiday decorations can pose safety hazards for your cat or dog. So San Diego County's Animal Service Department is offering these tips to protect your pet. Keep pets away from mistletoe, holly, and poinsettias, since these are toxic to animals. Consider using artificial holiday plants instead. Chocolate is toxic to pets, so keep stockings with chocolate treats out of reach, as well as any chocolate cookies you might leave out for Santa. Anchor your Christmas tree so pets can't tip it over. Clear fishing twine tied to the top of the tree and secured to a ceiling or wall is a simple way to keep your tree standing and protect your ornaments too. Never use tree preservatives in water in your Christmas tree stand, since this can be deadly if cats or dogs drink it. Cats love to play with tinsel and curling ribbon, but then they'll try to eat it. Tinsel is toxic and ribbon can obstruct your pet's intestinal tract. So keep these items away from curious critters. Hide electrical cords from your pets and make sure they can't play with or knock over any candles. Many dogs and cats get overwhelmed with all the hustle and bustle of the holidays, so having a quiet room allows them to escape and sleep undisturbed. On New Year's Eve, loud booms from fireworks can scare your canine companion. Some dogs will jump over fences to escape the noise. They run for miles and become lost. So set aside a safe, quiet place and be sure your dog is wearing identification just in case. Microchip both dogs and cats, since they slip out the door unnoticed while you're busy greeting holiday visitors. And if someone finds your lost pet, a vet's office or shelter can scan for a microchip and you can easily be reunited. County Animal Service offers low-cost microchipping every Tuesday through Sunday, which includes national registration. You can also sign up for Finding Rover and upload a photo of your pet using your computer or smartphone. This free service uses facial recognition to help lost and found dogs be reunited with their owners. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chardé Fontenot.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
Next up, Nadine Abbott
East County Magazine's longtime reporter covering wildfires and emergencies, shares her holiday memories growing up in Acapulco, Mexico.
Memories of Christmas past in Acapulco. When growing up, every December my dad drove us to Acapulco for the winter holiday. It was great to leave Mexico City for those 2 weeks. We kids always had a lot of fun. Suffice it to say, Acapulco was not the tourist center it has become. As we used to joke, you could still drive in the city. The hotel we stayed at was called Hotel Papagayo, and it has not been there for a few decades. The rooms were small and cozy, and it sat on a large property where we kids could go get lost and even play with deer that lived on the property. After the morning at the beach across the Costera Miguel Alemán at Hornitos Beach. These days, it is a working-class beach. It had the softest and finest sand I have ever experienced, and the waves were quite small, therefore safe for children to play in the water. The palapas, none brought their own umbrellas, were rented out, and you could eat fish and coconut right on the beach. But it was a Christmas dinner that was different. Given we are Jewish, it was a different affair from the fun and games of Hanukkah, where it was far less formal. The hotel had an open-air eating hall, which was decked with lights and deer, not reindeer. Rudolph was missing, and the biggest Christmas tree you have ever seen. I was 7 or 8 at the time, so I suppose any tree would be huge. Yet this was a pine tree in an area of Mexico known as Tierra Caliente, Hotland, where palm trees are common, as well as other tropical plants. This tree was probably brought from near Mexico City, where pine trees are common due to the elevation. There is one more important detail. There were no gifts under the tree. The music leading to the affair was a classic posada, and the meal itself was festive, with turkey and rice and vegetables. There was also dessert, usually yellow cake or flan. For those who wanted it, there was salted cod, Veracruzana style, which is a tomato-based sauce, hot peppers, and vegetables. We never ordered it out of fear that the fish was still salty. When it comes out of a barrel, the dried-out husk is covered in a thick crust of salt and fully dehydrated. There were also Mexican candies to share, some made out of coconuts, which are very common in Acapulco. Others made out of tamarind paste with salt and chili. We kids loved them, and we always took some home when the holiday was over, and we went back to school on January 2nd. Why, you might ask, there were no presents under the tree? In Mexico, like many other countries, that was the first day of Advent that ended on January 6th, when the three wise men came to give the gifts at the manger to baby Jesus. Of course, we did not expect gifts of clothes, sometimes given for Christmas, or for that matter toys for the wise men day. But in a way, those dinners, somewhat formal for a tropical area, are full of good memories. It was a time we did look forward to. In the spirit of the season, the Mexican wish is Feliz Navidad y Próspero Año Nuevo. Merry Christmas and a prosperous New Year. This is Nadine Abbott for KNSJ in Descanso and East County Magazine.
And now we hope our readers will enjoy this excerpt from a U.S. Army Band Christmas concert back in 2009. It's got a little bit of country in it for our East County listeners.
Thank you.
And we'll end our show today with some holiday wishes from the children's choir.
Baritone.
In a year, our troubles will be miles away. Here we are, as in golden days, happy golden days of yore. Precious friends who are dear to us,
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.